Hello, and welcome to a special program I am moderating that is part of a series on health access by CME Outfitters. The CME webcast is titled Open Enrollment: Rewriting the Rules of Access in Clinical Trials. This program is supported by an independent medical educational grant from Johnson & Johnson. This activity may include discussions for products or devices that are not currently labeled for use by the FDA. We, the faculty, are responsible to disclose any off-label or investigational uses. So my name is Dr. Monica Peek. I'm the Ellen H. Black Professor in the Department of Medicine at the University of Chicago, where I also serve as the Associate Director for the Chicago Center of Diabetes Translation Research. I'm thrilled to be joined today by two colleagues who are really experts in the field of clinical trials. So we're going to start with Dr. Leanne Chen. Leanne, would you mind introducing yourself to our audience today?
So I'm Leanne Chen. I'm an adult gastroenterologist. I direct the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Translational Research Program at Rutgers Robert Wood Johnson Medical School in New Brunswick. And inflammatory bowel disease is one where we're seeing, the incidence and the prevalence, explode kind of in all sorts of races and ethnicities worldwide, but we're not seeing that translate into our clinical trials. And so I'd love to discuss more about that today.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. I'm also excited to have Dr. Priscilla Pimu with us today. Priscilla, would you mind introducing yourself to the crowd?
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Priscilla Pamo. I'm a professor of medicine, a general internist at Morehouse School of Medicine, where I also serve as interim chair for our Department of Medicine, associate director for our Clinical Research Center, and associate dean for clinical research. It's really great to be on here with you all.
Thank you both for joining us. You have a lot of expertise. I'm really looking forward to our conversation. And you've both been really leading voices in advancing equity in clinical trials, and involving culturally responsive communication and specifically in the research that involves engaging communities. And so I'm really excited to really just dig into how we can expand fair access in clinical trials and how we can particularly build trust with both patients and communities. So welcome.
Thank you.
Our first learning objective for today is to assess the socioeconomic, geographic, and systemic barriers that can contribute to disparities in clinical trial access, particularly in underserved or community-based settings. And then our second learning objective is to identify interprofessional strategies, including the use of culturally responsive communication, patient navigators, and advocacy partnerships to engage underrepresented patients in clinical trial discussions and enrollment. So let's begin first with the clinical rationale and context for what we would like to call inclusive research. And so to ground our discussion, we're going to start by hearing from a patient navigator and community health nurse, Ms. Valerie Worthy. And she's going to talk about what she's learned over the years to help create optimal spaces for having conversations about clinical trials. Let's watch the video.
So I have been a nurse for 43 years, and the majority of my work was being either a community health nurse, public health nurse, or a home infusion nurse. So I got a wonderful opportunity to find out about the community. After I would provide care, I would talk to my patients and they would share their struggles, their barriers, and really begin to build relationships in the community. And so more importantly, then I began to listen to patients and people in the community about the struggles that they had, anxiety about treatment, and fear of clinical trials. So that kind of got me on my path and even my passion to engage the community even more, and then to provide more education in our community, including our faith communities, about cancer and clinical trials. Some of this is related to Tuskegee. Some of it is not. Some of them just have fear about being a guinea pig. And so I tried to figure out how can I normalize this to make this make sense to people. So I thought about, what do people take commonly? Over-the-counter drugs. And of course, most people say, yes, they have. And I said, did you know that they were on a clinical trial? And the expressions that I see on people's faces are, I can't even describe it. They're like, yes, that was on a clinical trial. Absolutely. And do you know how they decide what doses we're going to take and how frequently we're going to take it? They didn't know that either. I said, despite the majority of the people that participate in a clinical trial. And so what we do know when it comes to over-the-counter medications, the average person, the majority of the people are like 60-year-old white men, and our doses are measured by their height and weight. So we're not counting. So suppose the two tablets that we take every 4 hours, we need to take one every 6 hours. But we don't know that. And so we're not represented. So don't you want to be represented in this?
So this video shows why speaking directly to patients concerned with evidence using language that's very accessible is important, and also why inviting patients, specifically sort of saying, "Hey, this is like really important. Don't you want to be involved?" Inviting them into the trial process really counts. Why that's important. And so you've just heard some of the common barriers in the front line. And so we're going to do our first of the night's audience response questions. And so the question is, how often do you discuss clinical trials? How often do you take this opportunity to discuss trial opportunities with patients from underserved communities? Right. So we see that most people say sometimes, and only a small population, the very minority, says regularly that they're looking for opportunities. And so what we want to be able to do is have clinical trials be part and parcel of just the infrastructure and fabric that's part of our healthcare system apparatus so that it makes the choice, the easy choice, like we say with healthy food or a healthy environment, and that it shouldn't be something that is challenging for physicians to do. It shouldn't be something that is hard for patients to enroll in. And so we're going to talk to you about some of the ways to help make that happen. So we're going to start by talking about some of the disparities that we see in patient enrollment. And so if you look at these two sort of graphics, these show the median population and the medians of our population demographics. And then the one on the right shows the median of the participation in trials. And so if you look, you'll see that there is some underrepresentation by every racial and ethnic group except for non-Hispanic whites. And so I'm going to ask Leanne to talk a little bit more about what this means for evidence and care.
Thanks. So, yes, you can see, pretty clearly that there is underrepresentation of, non-white groups. And this is important because, we are missing important information about efficacy and safety when we have like these skewed population distributions in our clinical trials. And so this is really a missed opportunity to get, like the key safety and efficacy data that we want from our studies. And furthermore, it means that access is to like the most novel therapy is gated for certain populations. And the baseline, like the first step and the solution really is just measuring and reporting participation by race and ethnicity for every study. And in that way, we can really target our outreach where gaps are still persisting.
But one thing I thought was really interesting is that when you actually zoom in on some of the numbers, they change a bit. And so If we actually go back and look at African Americans, we'll see that they're 13% of the population and 10% of the clinical trial representation. But if we dig in a little bit further, we'll see that some of these gaps widen. So if we look at certain specialties like oncology or cardiovascular disease, we see that Blacks and Hispanics show up far below what we would anticipate based on the disease burden. And so, and in some for some groups, they're like zero present in the clinical trials themselves. And then we know that some of the clinical trials actually don't report on race or ethnicity, which further exacerbates the problem of knowing exactly what's going on. And so, Priscilla, can you talk a little bit what the impact, and it's sort of obvious, but can you walk us through what the implications of this could be?
Right. As you pointed out, cardiology does mirror this. Major diabetes studies show this as well, that Hispanic, Latino, non-Hispanic, Blacks, and Southeast Asian patients are underrepresented. But the reporting is also spotty. And what happens is when groups are missing, the evidence is skewed. You might miss safety signals. And that then guarantees that when people then use these medications, you will have effects that were not accounted for. And for me, what that does is, first of all, it adds to sort of the distrust that we hear about related to medicines and the healthcare system and science. And on the other side, it just means there are gaps in people's health outcomes and who has access to what treatment. So it really matters.
Absolutely. The other thing that it underscores for me is why data quality is important. Because if we don't have the data, we can't understand what's happening. And right now, in the current environment that we're in, there's a big push to sort of say that we don't really need data. We don't really need to collect it by race and ethnicity. And if we, that just shuts the lights out. We're just stumbling around in the dark. We have to be able to understand where there are gaps, so and understand what those gaps mean before we can begin addressing them. And so we can only do this when we have complete data, when we have accurate data, and when we have that comprehensively over time. And so I'm going to move to our next slide, where we can, and so I consider that a myth that's sort circulating in the public domain right now. I'm going to bust another myth, which is that underserved patients are never interested in clinical trials. And this is one that has been with us for a long time. And I do know that there are many that are not for legitimate reasons. However, we do know that that's not always the case. And many do say yes. There's one survey, cancer study that surveyed patients and found that only 32% of patients had ever even been asked. And of those who were asked, 84% said yes. And so what we do know is that if we can again normalize the asking process, if we can make it eligible to everyone, do warm handoffs in the navigation, if we can make the system structure easy for everyone, for clinicians and patients alike, then we're going to increase that patient enrollment for everyone, including those who we may not think are going to be interested in this. And so what we know is that these gaps, like I was mentioning earlier, can change care. And so we know that evidence varies by populations for lots of different reasons. And so when trials lack the kind of diversity that we have historically seen, or that they have historically lacked diversity, then where our ability to generalize them to wide populations where we know there's genetic variation across the globe, then we it is difficult to sort of to say that this medication is going to work the same for everyone. And so, Leanne, can you walk us through this slide that talks a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So, I was just going to mention, for one, a great example of this would be the angioedema risk that comes with ACE inhibitors. So, that risk is higher in Black patients, and treatment response can differ as much as 40%. And so, if we have dosing guidance that's built on a very narrow population, then that has huge implications for approvals and appropriate dosing for, the real patients that we're treating. And I think, the what we need to do is to acknowledge this, right? Not to hide it, but to say, this is a known limitation, and that's why, your representation, your participation really matters, and we just need to be transparent about, the history of research to kind of build that trust or rebuild that trust sometimes.
Absolutely. And rebuilding trust is really important. And that word sort of implies that trust has been lost. And we're in a moment right now where I have worked my entire life to rebuild trust in our governmental institutions. And we're seeing sort of the erosion of that currently. So we're going to have to go through another wave of rebuilding that. But right now, for certain marginalized populations, that historical legacy around unconsented sterilizations, the Tuskegee study, prison experiments, and so many other things that sort of launched the whole movement around IRBs and ethics, the whole field of ethics, led us to where we are today, where we can pretty confidently say that we know that these studies are going to be safe for our patients. That is something that helps strengthen our ability to enroll patients in studies. And that's something that we should be proud of when we're having these conversations. And so, Priscilla, can you talk a bit about this slide and how we should be using these as anchors, for conversations with patients?
Thank you. I think this is key. If we look at the responses from the poll questions, it was about 50 something percent that said, I don't. And I can only guess as to why that is the case. So if you would just focus in on this fact that it's going to be a question that comes up. And like our Ms. Worthy said, you have to normalize participation in trials. If the question is, how do we approach this in a conversation? That's what this slide is sharing with us. One, name the past, acknowledge the past. We have to be transparent about people's experiences and what it means. At the same time, let's talk about what is now available. What are the guardrails that are in place to make sure that when a person chooses to participate in a trial, that their interests are safeguarded? What is the role of IRB oversight? What is the role of independent safety boards? What is the kind of ongoing monitoring that happens in a study? What does informed consent look like? What should people be looking for when they choose or decide that they want to examine the possibility of taking part in a study? How should they think about what is listed about the study? What kind of questions should they ask? So in clinic, we can enhance the trust with for action. So you acknowledge, you explain protections, you demonstrate transparency, give people time to ask you questions and answer them in all honesty, and then follow up on commitments. I think transparency is the biggest first thing that we need to do. But you're already in a relationship with these patients. They trust you as their provider. Take it to the next level.
Excellent. I'm just going to note that I see some questions coming in about what can we do? What are the interprofessional practices? All of that is going to be coming in our second learning objective. So stay tuned. We are going to get to that shortly. So I just want to make sure that people are aware that we are going to be addressing that. One of the things that I do want to make sure that we cover is some of the ways that barriers can show up. They're not just patient barriers. And how I was mentioning earlier that we need to have systems where it's easy for physicians and for patients alike. And there are many system barriers that can sort of block the whole process for clinical trials before the conversation can even start. And so we have to ask ourselves, is our healthcare system optimally set up to enroll patients, and not just enroll them, but enroll them in a welcoming and supportive way? I'm from the South, and so I'm always liking to hug people and imagine myself wrapping my loving arms around patients. Can we say that we're doing the same when we're trying to enroll them in clinical trials? And so there are a lot of common barriers that really stem from a lack of infrastructure, a lot of research infrastructure, or the distance to the mothership, the academic medical center that's conducting the home base is really far away. There may be other barriers around payments or stipends, or insurance limitations, language accessibility. Are we giving the materials at a reading level that's appropriate? Are we translating them into all the languages that are appropriate? Are we doing all that we can as an institution to make entry into this trial as easy as possible for patients so that when we as providers are trying to introduce that, we're not, encountering stumbling blocks ourselves?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think in addition to all of the system barriers that you had mentioned, there's a number of potential provider barriers that can really play an issue as well. So people may feel like, oh, I don't know what the trials are, or I'm not comfortable discussing them. And as you mentioned before, there's this myth, right? Not true, but there's this myth that, patients are disinterested. And so a provider may never even bring up the topic. And then there's also sometimes, this provider concern that, oh, I don't have the training to do this. This is kind of outside of my wheelhouse. Maybe somebody else will do it. But hopefully, everybody who's here today, is interested in learning ways to overcome some of these barriers and kind of take a little bit of like individual responsibility for improving the situation.
Absolutely, Leanne. And sometimes even when the interest is there, everyday realities can stand in the way of a yes to participation. So if there are language barriers, or you may both be speaking English but using the same words, but the meaning does not come across, it can be a problem that prevents the door to participation from ever opening. Sometimes it's just the reality of life. The person has a work schedule and the clinic or the research center is only open while they're at work. That can be an issue. Or they've had prior negative experiences. They may have caregiving responsibility. People, because of prior negative experiences, may feel like you're experimenting on me. I don't want to be experimented on. Or some people might have worries about immigration, about people losing their privacy. People are very worried about that. What does this mean? I've had people say, if I get compensated for the study, will it change my tax situation? Those can all be things that come up. And so there can also be paperwork hurdles, issues with translation, notarization, requiring an ID from participants. Basically, knowing all of these issues is our opportunity to then create a pathway. So, depending on what the issue is, if we engage with our patients, we'll learn what those issues are and we can solve for a lot of them. So, this is my pitch to say when people share, kind of understand what the issue is and create a path to yes.
So now we're going to try and learn some of translate some of what we've learned into practical methods to communicate, navigate, and enroll patients, which is what a lot of people are asking for. But before we do, we have another audience response question. And so the question is, you just heard a lot about some of the barriers. What is the biggest barrier that you personally have experienced to discussing clinical trials? So the most common reason is that we just don't know what trials are available. And that I think is a real concern. We have and then a lot of the other things that just happen in the clinic setting. We're busy. We may not have the staff. We're concerned about our patients, both about the safety of the trial itself and that they may not understand what's happening, what they're getting into. And so all of those, I think, are realistic concerns. But how do we as providers know all the trials that are happening in our hospital? And so that is something that is an important area to address as well. Leanne, Priscilla, any immediate reactions to this?
Almost like a little relieved, to hear this, because I feel like, the lack of knowledge about which trials are available might be, say perhaps the easiest to fix, wanting that knowledge and going out and getting it, or, as a researcher, providing that information to, colleagues, is something that, that we can just do out of our own, like will.
Absolutely. What I like to share to both providers and to patients is clinicaltrials.gov. People can search by their disease condition. They can search by their zip codes. It'll tell you the studies that are enrolling close to where you are. I feel like empowering your patients to look, they have an interest for those who do have an interest. That way, they know what to bring up to you. And in your case, depending on what institution you're in, besides clinicaltrials.gov, look for those resources. I'm aware that there's some electronic health record systems that will match patients to appropriate clinical trials that they could potentially participate in. So all of those are opportunities, but I think a key thing is to empower your patients with the knowledge that if you have a health condition, you're wondering if there's a clinical trial that's going on close to you or whatever, you can search on clinicaltrials.gov.
Right. That's important because many people are looking for, is there, I'm at the end of the road as far as treatment option.
Absolutely.
Is there something new around the corner that I can have access to? And so patients are often motivated to find something else. And so it's not just us trying to sort of expand the science. It may be patients looking for another answer for themselves. And so let's move to thinking about how we may talk to patients and make some of the conversations easier by addressing some of the patient's concerns. And so we may think about comprehension at the system level. So we can always, we have things that are embedded in our computers to sort of assess literacy. We usually have teams in our hospitals that can help us to make sure that our, flyers and visual aids and all that kind of stuff are using plain language. As physicians, we learn a second language as, providers. And so making sure that we're translating things back into normal, regular English, or that English needs to be translated into another language, making sure that we're using visual aids. Someone asked about teach back in the questions. Absolutely. I'm using teach back just like we would in clinical practice. I'm doing that as part of enrollment. Using cultural brokers. We've heard from our patient navigator. We're going to hear from her again. Having multiple touch points and really using what we call transcreation. And I've talked a lot about that in some of the other podcasts that I've done, but using community-based organization and people from the community to help create the materials themselves, not just take our materials and translate them, but to co-create materials. For patients, all of these are important. And then Priscilla, I know that you're an expert in health literacy and thinking about how that is relevant to the clinical trial context. And so do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Not an expert, just someone with an opinion about this. But so it just always gets me when we talk about health literacy, like it is the patient doesn't have a high health literacy level. I don't think that that's the frame. I want us to reframe that entire conversation and see health literacy as a system attribute.
Yes.
Now, regular literacy can be a person's attribute, but health literacy is a system attribute. So, for us as healthcare providers in our practices, in our clinics, just to think about how we are communicating things to our patients and making sure that they understand. I love this list of strategies or tactics to use in making sure that that happens. I think cultural brokers, community health workers, promotores, whatever we choose to call them, are amazing. And depending on your practice, actually having people in your practice be that for you, I think creates an engagement and a connection with your community that goes beyond, hey, I have a health issue and I'm here for this transaction. So I think it's great. It'll help your patients really trust you in your practice. But yes.
Great. One person asked, specifically going back to the teach back. When I use teach back with patients in clinical trials or about clinical trials, are there any particular key points I should confirm that they understand? Are any frameworks or anything like that? Leanne or Priscilla, anything that you want to talk about when you're specifically using teach back?
Do you want to take that, Leanne?
No, I think the key things, especially at enrollment, that you want patients or potential subjects to understand is one, the benefit, whether it's a benefit to them or someone else, and then the risks, and that it's voluntary. So, those are the things that I'm wanting to hear back from patients that they understand, about the informed consent process.
Right. So what is going to be expected of them? What can they expect to experience? Who should they go to if they have any questions? All of those things. And more importantly, whatever they discuss in the clinic, that that is not the end of it, that they can take that document with them to their family, to their trusted people, and take another look at it before they get to a decision, that it is not rushed.
I hope that the person who put this question in got a sense of the answer, but I'm just going to quickly go over it just in case. And they said that you're touching on this already, but one of my more mature Black patients, I think they mean in age, mentioned the Tuskegee study when I brought up a trial. How can I acknowledge the history appropriately while still encouraging participation? And so I think that as we're talking about sort of acknowledging that and building trust, I think honesty and transparency is so important to that. And so I'm like, yes, anytime that you made me feel mistrustful, that is something that has been on our government. All of that happened and more. And so what I'm here to say now is that a lot of that has changed, that those horrific things that happened in our country, that happened in Nazi Germany, all of those were things that motivated the world to make sure that studies were going to be safe for people who were vulnerable, that people who didn't have all of their rights, who didn't have decisional capacity, who may have been imprisoned, who we knew were being structurally oppressed, had safeguards put in place so that they wouldn't be involuntarily experimented on, because we'd already seen what had happened in this country, across the globe, and in other specific countries. And so we'd already just experienced all those horrors that led to safeties for people like us. And that, I'm a researcher. I'm here seeing you in clinical practice, but I do 80% of my time doing research. And so I know, having to put all of my studies through the IRB, how diligent they are in making sure that their primary concern is patient safety. And so I think part of what I do is talk about, my lived experience as a Black person, acknowledging what they may be feeling is real, and that my role in healthcare is that of a clinician as well as that of a researcher, and how I interface with the IRB. And so I think all of these things are part of how we build trust with patients. And the transparency and the accountability, I think, are all part of that. I'm gonna have Leanne and ask you to walk through this conversational map, which gets to some of our other patients. other audience members questions about sort of some of the conversations that we have. And like, I'm in a busy clinic, and how do I do these things? And so some of the logistics of how to make this happen in a clinical setting.
So, I like to think of kind of like three time periods. One is, before the visit, before you ever see the patient. Second is like during the visit, and then afterwards. So going into a visit, it's important to kind of do your pre-charting. If you're seeing a patient the next day, look and see, is this a patient who could potentially go into a trial that I know about? Or, this patient looks like they're running out of medical options. Maybe I should be looking into trials that they can, go into. And then have, the flyer, have the materials ready to go, have it ready to go in that patient's language. So that will facilitate enrollment and approaching, patients during your very busy like clinic schedule. During the visit, I think it's really important that, we're talking to patients about the benefit, who's benefiting. Sometimes it's the patient. It could be an interventional trial. This is, a therapy, if they've run out of other therapies. But sometimes it's not. Sometimes the benefit is to future, future generations, future patients. And I think that that's, really important for patients to understand. One, whether they have a personal benefit to participating, but also, there's been these studies that have been done, looking at, best ways to cope with stress, for example. And they show that it's not, like taking a long walk or a bubble bath or whatever, but it's volunteering. It's the ability to kind of get out of your own situation and think about, serving others or helping others. And so, don't take away that potential, opportunity for your patient to bless someone else. Give them that opportunity to participate in, volunteering for others. The other thing is, talking about safety. So safety is oftentimes a concern for patients. So, how are we going to make sure that we're going to keep them safe? What are the labs that are, part of the study? What are the visits that are part of the study? And really using that teach back. To make sure that they understand that. And of course, always letting patients know it's when you, if you say, okay, it's not like you can't change your mind. If you start the trial, it seems like it's not working out for you. It's too much. It's, this isn't what you thought it would be. You can always say, I don't want to participate anymore. And that's an option. I think the other things that kind of help in terms of facilitating, access to trials is one, doing a warm handoff, that same day. So if you are lucky enough to have a team and a coordinator, having somebody there to take that interested patient and, go over the details of the study, within a short period, I think is helpful. And then the post visit, or the follow-up, it's just making sure that, you're following up with, the patient soon after, you're closing the loop about, one, any questions that they have, they don't have to be forced into giving an answer, right there. But, if they want time to think about it or talk about it with someone, make sure that you check in with them afterwards to see if they have any remaining questions, clear up any questions that they might have or barriers that might be in the way, and just making sure that, the whole team, the research team is involved.
Great. So we can summarize this process as the first 24 hours, you want to identify eligibility, offer it to the patient, and then do a warm handoff. By the second 24 hours, you want to have an eligibility decision. And then by the next 24 hours, so it's 72 hours, 3 days, you want to have a navigator follow-up. So a 3-day process. So really just sort of clicking along at a rapid speed.
And role clarity will speed this process. The clinicians make the offer and they link it to goals. Your nurses or APPs will explain in plain language and use teach back. Your coordinators and navigators will handle eligibility and logistics. The pharmacists or interpreters and interpreters will ensure safe language concordant care, and your front desk and admins trigger and track the warm handoff. One team, one workflow. And navigators make trials very doable. They bring language and cultural match. They handle logistics. They help with scheduling, transport, forms. And the programs that add navigation will lift underrepresented participation from about 9% to 16% and double retention. And that is huge.
That's a pretty big percentage. One of the things, and so we know that navigators have been so effective in doing so many things. To know that they can also work in clinical trial participation is really important to know. There are a lot of things that come up in visits, and so we're going to We can actually address them in the way that we talk with patients. You'll see on this slide some things that you may have heard inadvertently, even if you're not talking about clinical trials. We're just going to try and address some of these. So, Priscilla, I'll let you take the first one.
Okay. When someone worries about being used, basically I say you get to keep your usual care. The study adds more eyes on you. You decide at every step, as Leanne shared, just saying yes doesn't mean you're stuck with yes. You can continue to reevaluate. You can stop whenever you want. And then I pause and I ask, what would make this feel safe for you? And kind of listen to what they share.
Yeah, and I kind of want to reiterate sometimes to patients that, safety and quality of care, it doesn't go down when you're in a study. If anything, it goes up, right? It's like it's more visits, it's more people checking in on you and making sure that things are going okay. And again, if something's not going right, if this isn't what you thought it would be, you can change course. That's the beauty of kind of longitudinal care, both in clinical care but also in research, is that you can pivot after the initial decision.
Right. And I think that one thing that some of our patients who come from historically oppressed and marginalized situations have a little less comfort with is the uncertainty. And that's because of so much of the uncertainty that has been sort of baked into how people are being forced to live. And so that has a lot of negative connotations. And so the uncertainty of science may not feel quite so like, what is happening here? We have to get used to sort of normalizing this and how we talk about science and discovery. And also just saying, listen, Leanne, like you just said, we can set up a plan B before we start. So if X happens and this isn't sort of what you expected, or if something, isn't going the way that we want, we're going to do Y. People a lot of times can feel more comfortable if they know that there's a fallback plan, so that they're not just sort of floating in space with all of this, existential angst.
Exactly. And kind of as you were saying about the uncertainty, there may be uncertainty about, for example, the trial or the study drug and whether or not it works, but we should try to remove any of that uncertainty as it relates to the study. So for example, how much might this cost me? Is it cost me for me to come and park for the study visit? Like, is that going to be covered if something, if I experience an adverse reaction, is the study sponsor going to cover the cost, or is my insurance going to cover the cost? Do I have to cover the cost? Those are important things to know, and explain. We won't know perhaps like whether you get placebo or drug, but these are the things that we know, and we'll take care of for you.
Yes. Two questions that have come up that I'm just going to sort of briefly hit. One says, what should I say if a Spanish-speaking patient asks about a clinical trial flyer in our waiting room and we don't yet have translated materials? Either one of you want to take that?
We don't have it now, but we'll get it to you in such and such amount of time.
Honesty is always the best policy. So yeah, this is our limitation. We don't have it yet. And if you hadn't planned on translating it, then maybe you don't have a large Spanish population, and this is the only Spanish speaker who happened to come to you. There are a lot of ways, ChatGPT, a lot of things that are now at our disposal that weren't available even a few years ago to make a lot of services and things that we do a lot easier now than they would have been in the past. Another person asked semi-relatedly about patients who are undocumented and worried about privacy. And so how do we address their immigration concerns when discussing clinical trial participation?
Prior to now, when I've had studies where, I was in the All of Us research program that had asked a lot of people. Basically, if there were policies, for instance, that required an ID or certain kind of things, we changed them so that people didn't, there is not a research-related reason why a person has to submit a government-issued ID. Now, if there it's a study that has a research-related reason, that's a whole different conversation. So think through the barriers that suggest a loss of privacy or make them feel more vulnerable, and ask yourself, is that a requirement to answer the question that that study needs to answer? And if it is not, then there's an opportunity to do something about it.
Absolutely. All right, so we are going to hear again from our patient navigator, Miss Valerie Worthy. And she's going to talk about her role as a trusted community resource and some strategies that she's used to engage patients who are mistrustful of clinical trials. So let's take a look at this video.
Not developing a relationship with that patient. Patient wants to know that it's a team effort, and that they are part of that team. They're part of that decision-making process, that you thought of them as a person and not a number, and that you really care about their decision, and that if they have questions, they're not intimidated by even the thought of asking a question. You've gone through the discussion, maybe talked about the clinical trial, and then pause to say, now, how can I help you? What have I missed? What questions do you have? Did I meet your need today? I would say, imagine that this is your family member. And you have to try to explain to them that they have cancer and what is the best course. And think about your parent, your sister, your child, brother, that is there alone, and someone is explaining to them about a major choice that they have to make. What would you say, and what would you want that person to say to your family member? Just treat people the way that you will want to be treated and the way that your family member will want to be treated. If you do those things, you'll build a relationship with patients. Patients will feel comfortable asking you questions, and they will share their biggest desires, after the treatment. This is what I want to happen, and their biggest fears. And you will be able to treat them holistically. That would be my advice.
So while trial enrollment really is important to think about the process, it's also important to think about the relational aspects that may actually be more part of or more important to the big picture in getting patients to say yes to trial enrollment. So creating emotionally safe spaces, engaging in shared decision making where patients feel comfortable asking questions, all of those are equally important to the first 24 hours, making sure they're eligible, the second 24 hour, like all of that is key. But if patients don't feel like this is going to be a safe space for them, and like I can, ask questions and make sure this is the right thing for me, then that whole process is really for nothing. And so we have to be able to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to be able to care and to have the logistics down at the same time. So I like busting myths. There's another one that clinical trials are just way too complicated for community practice. And that may have been the case in the past, but isn't as much today. And so, Leanne, I'm going to ask you to sort of quickly run through how, why, and how that may be the case.
Sure. I think as it's increasingly recognized that, our trials are not reflective of, study populations, I'm seeing even, my industry colleagues saying, we don't want your like ivory tower academic medical center patients. We want, real patients. And, are willing to put in resources to help make that easier. And so, many trials are designed for community implementation. There's patient advocacy groups, for example, that will list, clinical trials for that disease. So you can just go to their website and kind of figure out, where the nearest center is and what sorts of trials are out there. There's more and more trials that are available where part of it is by telemedicine, or you can do e-consent to make it easier for patients. They may not necessarily even have to come in, to do a visit. And they're trying to make, protocols more simple. So there's like a whole field of science now, right? Like this pragmatic clinical trials to really have trials baked into, the workflow of your day-to-day care. And also I think sometimes there's this perception that like all studies are like randomized, placebo-controlled, studies. That's not true. Some of it, some of them are just safety registries, patients just consenting to be, pinged their text and make sure that they're okay. Some of them are prevention studies or digital health interventions. And so it's not that every trial is a big deal. There are also trials that are, for the amount of commitment or resources you have.
Great point. And so to make trials workable, we just need sort of three basic steps. Start small, build momentum, get easy wins, and then measure impact. And so I'm going to move to the next slide and talk about community network and sort of the reach. And knowing that it comes from lots of different spaces. And so again, we're not just thinking about what can happen in the academic setting, that we want to think about showing up at health fairs, partnering with schools and patient groups, using the local media to explain the benefits in plain language so that people on the radio are hearing about it. Every touch point, you're going to get a real person who may call back. Are you advertising on the bus? Thinking about from the provider side, we have research practice networks where we can set up peer mentoring and offer short continuing education courses on research communication, things like what we're doing right now. A lot of times we have quality improvement collaboratives. You can join sort of a research collaborative to help you figure out how to do this that you may not have been trained as a clinician investigator. And so all of these are things that help sort of lift this off the ground for everyone. And because it's a win-win, we want everyone to be represented in these trials. And so after today's discussion, our last audience response question, we want to know what might be your very next step. Excellent. So I think most everyone is going to, I mean, the majority of people are going to just try and find out what's available in your area. And I think that's a great next step because that was the biggest barrier in the first place. Like, I have no idea what's going on. So I think that most people are going to take the next step and figure out what is going on. So I think that's great. So we're going to end today, almost end, by thinking about some SMART goals. And those are goals that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant, and timely or sort of time bound. And so these are things that you can think about doing, like practicing cultural humility, turning communication and barrier closure into workable steps. And so Just thinking about some of these goals, I'll let you sort of look over them. Leanne, is there anything that you want to sort of highlight with these SMART goals?
Think, here are a number of tips, and there are a number of them. So, like, pick and choose the ones that work for you and for your practice. And it's a process, but I think just getting a few enrollments, getting a few trials under your belt, will really facilitate future participation.
Excellent. Any last parting comments, Priscilla?
I really want to plug the navigators. Think about those people in your practice who ask the most questions, who seem to be the most concerned. They tend to be the ones that, if you can get them to understand the need, they form like the best navigators. So anyone who has a lot of questions, a lot of concerns, look at them again, invite them in. And kind of teach them. I think they would be a really great addition to your practice as a navigator.
Excellent. It's always like the person who asks the question gets volunteered for the program.
No. The fact that they're thinking enough to ask all those questions and have that level of dissatisfaction is always the key. That's been my experience.
Exactly. No, I'm with you 100%. This recording will be available on the CME Outfitters Health Access Hub, along with other resources for both clinicians and patients. The hub also offers tools to help you build skills for creating a welcoming and inclusive environment. There are other activities in this series that can also be found on our Health and Access Hub, and we encourage you to check all of those out. So, Leanne and Priscilla, thank you, thank you, thank you for your insights today. Thank you to the CME Outfitters team for partnering with our program. Together, we can all sort of broaden our access to our patients, to clinical trials, and ultimately improve the care for everyone. Thank you so much. And with that, I will just say good night. Have a wonderful evening, and thanks again for joining us.